Topic 139, Psychic Powers. 1. I would like to pause here and point out two things that should be borne in mind. First, that many people are today living in the Atlantean state of awareness, in the Atlantean consciousness, and for them the expression of these lower psychic powers is normal, though undesirable. For the man who is a mental type, or who is overcoming gradually the psychic nature, these powers are abnormal, or should I say subnormal, and most undesirable. In this discussion with which we are now engaged, I am not dealing with the man with the Atlantean consciousness, but with the modern aspirant. For him to develop the previous racial consciousness and to revert to the lower type of development, which should have been left far behind, is dangerous and retarding. It is a form of atavistic expression. Secondly, that when a man is firmly polarized upon the mental plane, when he has achieved some measure of contact with the soul, and when his entire orientation is towards the world of spiritual realities, and his life is one of discipline and service, then at times, and when necessary, he can at will call into use these lower psychic powers in the service of the plan, and in order to do some special work upon the astral plane. But this is a case where the greater consciousness includes normally the lesser consciousness. This is, however, seldom done, even by the adepts, for the powers of the soul, spiritual perception, telepathic sensitivity, and psychometric facility are usually adequate to the demand and the need to be met. I interject these remarks as there are some enlightened men who use these powers, but it is always along the line of some specific service to the hierarchy and humanity, and not along any line connected with the individual. When a man has wandered into the bypaths of the astral plane and has left the secure place of mental poise and intellectual altitude, again I am speaking symbolically, when he has succumbed to glamour and illusion, usually being quite sincerely deceived and well-intentioned, and when he has unfolded in himself through misapplied stimulation and experiment, old habits of contact, such as clairvoyance and clairaudience, what can he do, or what shall be done to him to bring about right conditions? Many of these people find their way into the hands of psychologists and psychiatrists. Many are to be found today in our sanitariums and asylums, placed there because they saw things, or heard voices, or dreamed dreams, and because they had unfitted themselves for normal living. They appear to be a danger both to themselves and to others. They constitute a problem and a difficulty. The ancient habits must be dropped, but because of their antiquity, they are very powerful, and to drop them is easier said than done. The practices whereby the lower psychic powers have been developed must be given up. From a treatise on the Seven Rays, Volume 2, Esoteric Psychology 2, pages 476 through 478. 2. One of the major lessons to be learned upon the path of discipleship is to learn to distinguish that which is real from that which is illusion. What, then, is to be seen and heard by the medium when in trance or when giving an exhibition of clairvoyance or clairaudience? Several possibilities, which I might list as follows. 1. A revelation of the wish life of the person or group to whom the medium is addressing himself. This wish life takes form in proportion to the power of the unexpressed wish or the mental ability of the person or persons concerned. 2. A recognition by the medium of the thought forms or thought form to be found in the aura of the person in the audience or circle. These thought forms have been built over a space of time and are usually of someone deeply loved or as deeply disliked. They are often so real in appearance that the person can recognize them when described by the medium, and the medium can at the same time, by a process of telepathy via the solar plexus center, become aware of the things which the sitter wishes to hear, which will be in line with the usual mannerisms and methods of speech and thought of the departed or living friend. This accounts for the mediocre caliber of the usual utterance and statement made at a séance. The average person who frequents a séance is not usually of the highest grade of intelligence unless he is simply there as an investigator. 3. A few rare cases when a soul on the path of return to incarnation or immediately after death is impelled, for good and sufficient purpose, to make a contact with a friend or relative via a medium. Such cases are known and usually presuppose more than average intelligence on the part of the sitter, the communicator, and the medium. They constitute, however, the exceptional occurrence. 4. The revelation to the clairvoyant and clairaudient worker of much of the phenomena of the astral plane, which parallels that of the physical plane, and which is conditioned by the quality and caliber of the circle of people who constitute the audience. This the medium interprets to them, and it usually evokes recognition. I am here casting no doubt on the sincerity of the performance, nor on those mediums who are born with these clairvoyant and clairaudient faculties. I am only pointing out that the phenomena which they are contacting is astral in nature, and that anyone looking at a circle from the standpoint of the higher psychic powers would note around each sitter a group of astral forms, self-created, of those who have departed physical life through death, of those who are constantly in his thoughts, though still alive, and also a kaleidoscopic and changing process of appearing and disappearing forms, some quite nebulous and some quite substantial, according to the power of thought, which concern the wish life of the sitter, which are concerned with his home affairs, his business, or are built up around his health. The sensitive tunes in on these, connects them with the attendant thought forms, and hence the production of the usual performance found in the séance room or with the average audience. The medium is truly and accurately relating just what he sees and hears, and therefore is sincere and truthful. But because he receives no real training in the art of interpretation and in the technique of distinguishing the illusory from the real, he is, perforce, unable to do more than describe the phenomena seen and the words heard. This is a continuation of Topic 139, Psychic Powers. When, however, the mystic opens up these same powers, as is sometimes the case, the phenomena seen and the words which are heard can be of a very high order. Nevertheless, they are still astral, for they concern happenings and phenomena found upon the higher levels of the astral plane. He comes into contact with the spiritual or religious wish life of the race, and according to the basic trend of his individual aspiration at the moment, so will be his contacts. If he is an earnest and devoted Christian, he will see one of the beautiful and vital thought forms of the Christ there to be found. And in the wonder of that revelation, his love and his imagination and all that is best in him will be evoked in adoration and mystery. Hence some of the inspired writings and illumined visions of the mystic. If he is a Hindu, there may come to him a vision of the Lord of Love, Sri Krishna, or if a Buddhist, he may see the Lord of Light, the Buddha, in all his radiance. If he is an occult student, or a theosophist, or Rosicrucian, he may see a vision of one of the masters or of the entire hierarchy of adepts. He may hear words spoken, and thus feel assured, past all controversy, that the great ones have chosen him for special privilege and for unique service. And yet his consciousness has never moved from off the astral plane, and his contacts have only been a wonderful and inspiring expression of the phenomena of that plane, released to his inner sight and hearing through his aspiration. All this is brought about through the overactivity of the solar plexus center, stimulated by the energy pouring in from the heights he has attained in aspirational meditation. The results are very emotional in their nature, and the reactions developed and the consequent service rendered are on emotional levels. A great deal of this is to be seen among the teachers in the world at this time in many lands. Such teachers have been and are true aspirants. They have awakened in consciousness upon the higher levels of the astral plane. They have there seen the thought forms that humanity has created of the spiritual hierarchy, or the reflections on those levels of that hierarchy, a still more potent group of thought forms, and have heard repetitions of that which has been said and thought by the world aspirants of all time, all of it most beautiful, good, and true. They then proceed to teach and proclaim what they have thus heard, seen, and learned, and frequently do much good on astral levels. They are, all the same, confusing the reflection with the reality, the reproduction with the original, and the humanly constructed with the divinely created. Forget not that the astral plane is that whereon man has to learn to distinguish truth from error, and the real from the unreal. Thus, those who are deceived are only learning a needed lesson. The fact of the astral plane is being steadily recognized, and that is good. The fact of the existence of the spiritual hierarchy and of the masters is being brought to the attention of the masses, even if it is being done by those who are confusing the reflection and the thought form with reality. The question could here properly be asked, how can the mystic avoid this error and confusion? How can he distinguish the real from the illusory? This constitutes an individual problem for every mystic, and there is no one profound and scientific rule whereby he can guide his reactions. The only rules that I can give you are so simple that those who are occupied at this time with teaching and proclaiming that which they have astrally contacted may not like to follow them. The attitude of mind that will guard the mystic from astral delusion and error is 1. The cultivation of a spirit of true humility. There is a spiritual arrogance that masks itself behind a cloak of humbleness, and which is very prevalent at this time. It leads people to regard themselves as the chosen of the hierarchy to save the world. It leads them to look upon themselves as the mouthpieces of the masters or of the Christ. It tends to make them separative in their attitudes to other leaders and teachers, refusing to recognize the many aspects of the one work and the many methods that the mind of God has devised for reaching the masses. 2. The refusal to accept any contact or message that has personality implications, or that sets its recipient apart, thus tending to the development of a Messiah complex. I like that phrase. It is simple and concise, and illustrates dramatically the state of mind and describes the assured nature of the consciousness of many of the present teachers of humanity. A true contact with the hierarchy and the true accolade of service carries with it the conviction of the existence of the many servers in the one service, of the many messengers carrying the one message, of the many teachers of the many aspects of the one truth, and of the many and various ways back to the heart of God. When this all-embracing revelation accompanies the call to service, then the spirit of inclusiveness is developed, and the man can be sure that he is truly called to cooperate and convinced of the reality of his vision. 3. The freedom from emotional appeal. The true disciple and mystic is ever mentally polarized. His vision is free from the deluding reactions of the solar plexus center. His vision awakens the heart center and evokes the response of his personality energy focused in the Ajna center and produces eventually a centering in the place of light. This indicates the growing activity of the head center. He may later use controlled emotional appeal in dealing with the masses, but he himself seeks to remain free from all emotional control. From A Treatise on the Seven Rays, Volume 2, Esoteric Psychology 2, pages 569 through 573. 3. Negative, unintelligent mediumship and psychism reduces its exponent to the level of an automaton. It is dangerous and inadvisable because it deprives a man of his free will and his positivity, and militates against his acting as a free, intelligent human being. The man is not acting in these cases as a channel for his own soul, but is little better than an instinctual animal if he is not literally an empty shell, which an obsessing entity can occupy and use. From The Externalization of the Hierarchy, page 10. 4. At the same time, there are mediums of a very much higher order, whose lives are offered in service to advanced souls on the other side of the veil, and who give themselves so that their fellow men may learn of them. Thus, on both sides of the veil of separation, are souls aided and given opportunity to hear and serve. But these too would profit by a more intelligent training and by a more accurate understanding of the technique of their work and the organization of their bodies. They would then be better channels and more dependable intermediaries. From The Externalization of the Hierarchy, page 11. 5. The disciple, occupied with hierarchical plans for the future, has a completely open mind as regards the growth of true psychic powers. He deplores and represses all negative conditions and forms of thinking as he contacts them in his environment, but he encourages the growth of all forms of higher sensory perception that expand the human consciousness and enrich its content. From The Externalization of the Hierarchy, page 587. See also the topic Spiritualism and Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, pages 49 through 50 and pages 741 through 742.